Hello and welcome to Power Problems. I'm John Glazer. My guest today is Stephen Wertheim, Senior Fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and a visiting lecturer at Princeton University. Stephen, welcome back to the show.
It is great to be back and see you, John.
In a recent Foreign Affairs article, you criticized the Biden administration's foreign policy for essentially trying to have its cake and eat it too. Biden came into office promising to inject strategic focus into U.S. foreign policy, signaling that he understood the need to prioritize a kind of everything-to-everyone approach to the world and thus make hard choices about what not to do. But as president, you argue, he's evaded those hard choices. Can you explain that?
It's really hard to put ourselves in the moment when Joe Biden took office 3 years ago, because it now kind of seems like, it was inevitable that the United States would have what looks like a really traditional kind of foreign policy. But in fact, when Biden came in, he had criticized forever wars on the campaign. He had promised to make Saudi Arabia a pariah. And his team around him had recognized that U.S. foreign policy had gone awry in some fashion in the post-Cold War era, that the problem wasn't just getting Donald Trump out of office, but there needed to be a course correction. And that meant in part that the United States needed to stop with forever wars and be able to have more focus in its foreign policy, and maybe even put an end to the war on terror in an attempt to have a more, not just a more peaceful foreign policy, but to stop playing into the hands of, as they would see it, right-wing demagogues like Donald Trump, who could thrive off of people's fears of foreigners. And indeed, he did. So one of the first acts that the Biden administration took was to review U.S. policy toward Afghanistan, but then quickly the president announced in April that he was going to terminate that nearly two-decade-long mission in Afghanistan. And he delivered. And he very powerfully defended his decision to withdraw, even as the country was quickly taken over by the Taliban in August and September of that year. So if you kind of freeze history at that moment, you would see a different kind of Joe Biden and a different national security vision than what we see today. And so we should hold on to that because it really does reflect where a whole lot of people were in the Democratic Party as of the campaign of 2020. So then we have to ask, if that was their original vision, what's gone wrong? Where the United States is now managing two conflicts in which it's immersed in Europe, in the Middle East, precisely the regions that Biden had said that he wanted to put less of a priority on. And this is absorbing the time of the president and senior policymakers. So I argue that, in a word, the Biden administration wanted to prioritize without disentanglement. It wanted to be able to focus on security in Asia, as well as domestic needs and transnational challenges like climate change. But it wasn't willing to disentangle the United States from its political commitments and military positions in Europe and the Middle East. And as a result of that, of course, Afghanistan being the notable exception, if you want to expand the Middle East, the definition of the Middle East to South Asia. And the result of that is that, the U.S. had very limited tools to be able to have a more focused U.S. foreign policy and keep things quiet in entire regions of the world, Europe and the Middle East. And so while I don't, fault policymakers for, you know, not for failing to anticipate that Vladimir Putin would pull the trigger when he did on a full-scale invasion of Ukraine. I do think that there is a naivety, maybe even a hubris behind thinking that the United States can keep itself thoroughly enmeshed in the security arrangements of entire regions and then expect those regions to sit still and everyone to be essentially satisfied with the status quo so that Washington can turn its gaze somewhere else.
In that piece, you referenced that Biden initially directed the Defense Department to review the United States' global force posture. And of course, big surprise, the review found that U.S. force posture is pretty much exactly where it should be. You write, ever since, the Biden administration has avoided making structural reductions to any portion of U.S. global primacy, to the political objectives, defense commitments, and military positions that Washington has accumulated over eight decades. Let's say this review turned out to reflect your own assessment. What would it have said? Where should we retrench?
It would have said that the United States should significantly scale back its military posture in the Middle East. I think one could get down to maybe, want to be generous, two military bases, perhaps in Bahrain and Qatar, with forces there whose purpose would be to help keep the sea lanes open if necessary and if other actors were not willing to take care of that problem themselves. But it would involve backing away from the United States' de facto alliances with one set of actors in the Middle East, which in turn means intense enmity with another set of actors in that region. So a force posture review, of course, would have had to be coupled with a White House political review of what America's basic objectives were, because without that, you know, the Defense Department couldn't just make such a consequential choice. But, you know, there were signs that some in the White House were interested in such an approach, looking from the outside at the outset of the Biden administration. The other area where retrenchment would be desirable would be Europe. Now, here, I don't think it's a matter of taking dramatic action immediately. And what I would, you know, suggest that the Biden administration consider, and I would have said that then, but also applies now and going forward, would be a publicly announced plan to transition to European leadership of European defense through NATO and the EU over, let's say, two terms of a president, 8 years, a decade. That would shift the United States to a supporting role in European security. And what that review could have pointed out would be, first of all, U.S. vital interests in the Middle East are very few and don't require nearly the kind of political commitments and defense, de facto defense guarantees that the United States has. U.S. interests are more significant in Europe, and yet the vital interest that the United States has in keeping an illiberal hegemon from dominating the European continent or much of the European continent, those are not very affected right now because if you right-size the Russia threat, Russia is, to put it mildly, struggling to conquer Ukraine. It doesn't have a very good chance of going much further than that, at least in the foreseeable future. Moreover, and this is just as important, America's European allies are vastly wealthier, if you combine them, than Russia. And they have the wherewithal to defend Europe. What they're missing is a whole lot of things, but for short, let's say political will. Spending, cooperation, an adequate defense industrial base, and the incentives. And I blame Washington largely for those incentives, because when Washington is willing to provide for security, but then says out of another corner of its mouth, would you please do more and let's have the same control, but do it cheaper. Europeans have shown that they're willing to call our bluff on that. So this is why I think, you know, it's necessary, ironically, for Washington to take a leadership role in making a transition to European leadership of European defense. So, you know, I think those two basic approaches are still live. In fact, in many ways now compared to 2020, although the immediate circumstances in the Middle East and in Eastern Europe would make U.S. retrenchment more difficult, it actually makes it more desirable over the longer term and more feasible in Europe because Europeans have made commitments to spend more on defense. And because they are seeing that Donald Trump wasn't some blip, he wasn't an aberration, but rather he's maintained his grip on the Republican Party. Even if Donald Trump personally goes away, Joe Biden is awfully old. He doesn't necessarily represent the future of the Democratic Party, much less the United States. And Trump has really remade the Republican Party in his image. So these are, you know, Europe doesn't just have to Trump-proof its security. It needs to America-proof its security. Are the steps happening? No. That are necessary. And, you know, that's why I think Washington really does have to make these strategic decisions if it wants to get the result that will enable it to set the kind of priorities that policymakers say that they want to have.
I want to give you a chance to talk about the Biden administration's approach to Saudi Arabia. You mentioned that at the outset. This is one of those issues that Biden just completely caved on, especially now as he weighs a prospective formal treaty alliance with Saudi Arabia. Essentially, the deal would be a U.S. commitment to militarily protect and defend Saudi Arabia in exchange for Saudi normalization with Israel. What's the status of that prospective deal? Fill us in on how awful an idea it is.
Well, you're presuming that I think it's awful. You're quite correct about that, or at least it sounds awful. We don't have the details. It's a close hold on the details within the White House. But, you know, to go back to Joe Biden's starting point, he was thinking about reevaluating the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia. Ultimately, he didn't take many tangible actions. And so it's not surprising that, you know, when he decided not to retrench from the Middle East, he found that he also wasn't willing to throw overboard the U.S. relationship with Riyadh, and found reasons why it would be useful to have some influence with Saudi Arabia, especially over the war in Ukraine and the perennial issue of gas prices. Now, last summer, the Biden administration was exploring the kind of deal that you mentioned. Basically, in exchange, Saudi normalizes relations with Israel, extending the Trump administration's Abraham Accords approach. But instead of U.S. arms sales going to Saudi Arabia, there would be a U.S. security guarantee, even potentially in the form of a treaty, something the United States hasn't done for many decades, unless you count NATO enlargement. But this would be a bilateral U.S. Defense guarantee to Saudi Arabia. Then October 7th happened. So the idea was put on ice, but only put on ice. And the administration now wants to see, or at least some at high levels, would like to see that deal come back with one extra component thrown in, and that is some sort of Israeli steps, so-called irreversible steps, to create a Palestinian state. So there are three main components to this deal. There's also some guarantees that Saudi Arabia would make to limit its relationship with China. And I don't know if it's still in the deal, but potentially U.S. help on civil nuclear energy for Saudi Arabia. But let's focus on, you know, what I think is the core of this, which is the U.S. security guarantee to Saudi Arabia. I think there's a feeling of the administration that, well, you know, we've already decided that the United States is not getting out of the Middle East. It's not going to significantly draw down from the Middle East. It's not going to change its objectives very much. So now our best move is to show that we're committed to the Middle East and try to use our leverage to stabilize the region. And so normalization for Israel would help Israel perhaps produce some political benefits for Biden. And the United States potentially would gain some sort of influence over Saudi Arabia, in part to keep China out by extending this security guarantee. I think part of the logic is probably that, well, you know, does the security guarantee really matter? Maybe it serves as an extra deterrent. So there's a positive to it. But then one could argue that at the end of the day, it's always a political decision to go to war for another country. You know, they could minimize what the security guarantee entails compared to the, you know, political level assurances that already exist. So why is this a bad idea, in my view? It's a bad idea because I just can't see anything that would warrant the United States giving a formal treaty binding the United States to go to war for Mohammed bin Salman or whoever's in power in Riyadh. It's just unwarranted from the point of view of U.S. national interest. And I would say that even if I thought the Israelis were going to take significant steps toward the creation of a Palestinian state, which would be very meaningful in my view, if they were to do that. I don't think that they're going to do that. I don't see how this government is capable of delivering. I'm very skeptical that even if Netanyahu got out of power, another government would be capable of delivering. But even if they were, it is in fact a very serious thing for the United States to have a legally binding treaty commitment to defend another country. We've been giving these kinds of things out like candy for the last three decades. But I think it would change the U.S. calculation in the event that another state attacked Saudi Arabia. It would have changed the calculus when Donald Trump decided not to come to the defense of Saudi Arabia toward the end of his administration due to a Houthi attack that may have had Iranian involvement. So, you know, I think it's going to be potentially appealing if, you know, this deal gets through for senators to, you know, if it's supported by both Saudi Arabia and Israel, there will be a lot of, you know, clout on the Hill in favor of passing this kind of guarantee. And it'll be sold as something that's going to herald peace in the Middle East. And Joe Biden can shore up his left flank and say, okay, I know we've been through this horror in Gaza, but now I'm brokering the foundations for peace in the Middle East. But you know, the Middle East is just far too complex. Again, even if the deal goes exactly as hoped for, and things really do get better between the Israelis and the Palestinians, that's not the only problem in the region. And Americans need to understand that now they will continue to be entangled in this volatile place, now with an extra security guarantee to Saudi Arabia, and it's not going to enable the United States to shift its gaze to other things.
Your argument, I think, gets really crystallized when you say that genuine prioritization is kind of a pipe dream unless the United States actually does retrench, unless it makes choices about what not to do. Biden, for example, may have hoped, as we've talked about, that massive destabilizing wars in Europe and the Middle East didn't break out. But without a real change to the long-running status quo, we necessarily get sucked in to those conflicts in a way that probably that might exacerbate the problem. And you explain that we have two options for kind of stabilizing and heading off these conflicts. And they basically amount to diplomacy, which could accommodate the grievances of our adversaries and thus pacify the situation, or an actual shift of the burden of security to the states in the region. But as you point out, each of those options requires retrenchment. That's the goodie that we're willing to give. And that's a really interesting point. I want you to expand on it, but also I kind of want you to make the case, because it may not be obvious to our listeners that making such accommodations and backing out would improve things.
Right. So I tried to think through, what would be the best argument against my position? How could things actually go right for the United States while the United States maintains its desire for military primacy in a region? I have in mind Europe and the Middle East, but this could apply to any region, right? And one answer to that could be, well, everyone's pretty happy with the status quo, so you don't actually need to do much. But I don't think anyone really believes that if you look at the Middle East or if you look at Europe today, that the major actors are satisfied with the status quo. So let's throw that one out. So now you have two tools left. You can use diplomacy to make accommodations with those actors that are dissatisfied with the status quo and may otherwise seek to revise the status quo in their favor. And or you can try to signal to local actors, and here we're especially thinking about U.S. allies and partners, that if a crisis does arise, don't count on the United States to take care of it. You guys should take care of it instead. And, in theory, these approaches could be effective in preventing a crisis from occurring that would shift the U.S. focus to these regions. Or if a crisis does occur, making it not a crisis for the United States, making it a crisis that that local actors will handle. And in fact, if you look at the Biden administration's initial actions, it did employ like a mix of those two methods. Use diplomacy to make some accommodations with adversaries and rivals and send some signals to U.S. allies and partners that they should do more for their security. But it was a really half-hearted effort in both of those cases. And it clearly was not effective to prevent crises from arising or to allow local actors to handle those crises. And so the basic problem is that in the world that we see today, adversaries to the United States, they're pretty dug in. Iran isn't going to, change its calculus because the United States, offers some minor accommodation that doesn't involve the United States having a lesser role in the Middle East. Likewise, Russia. So when you take retrenchment off the table, you actually don't give your diplomats very much to work with. Now, it is possible, we don't know, it is possible that some serious accommodations with Iran or with Russia, if the war in Ukraine winds down, you know, might actually provide for stability and reduce the threats that those actors perceive. But I don't think it's close to being a viable option without U.S. retrenchment. But look, it would not be a sure thing even if the U.S. retrenched. And that's where the second option comes into play. It would be desirable to have local actors who will be able to defend themselves and manage regional problems. Now, how do you get them to do that? Well, we've tried for a very long time rhetoric, asking, you know, it was Barack Obama that began the now three president long spate of asking our European allies to do more and burden share and not be free riders. The United States is saying two things at the same time. We value U.S. leadership in the region extremely highly. This region matters immensely to our security, so much that we've got tens of thousands of our forces there. We've got security commitments to multiple states. We've imposed sanctions on our adversaries, et cetera, et cetera. Point number two. Well, you know, if something goes wrong, we might not be there. We'd really like you to handle it. Well, those two things don't really go together. If the United States cares so much about its leadership role in the region and handling regional problems, then it's probably going to take the lead in managing a problem if it does occur. And I think, you know, you really can't send both signals at once in an effective way. Now, you know, when you think about Europe today, maybe it's a little more complicated because of U.S. domestic politics. I think if Joe Biden were running against Joe Biden, sending the two contradictory signals that I've mentioned wouldn't be very, very effective. But now Europeans have to think about how sustainable whatever Joe Biden is claiming, how sustainable is the U.S. commitment to Europe. But, you know, as a practical matter for a U.S. policymaker, I think we've, you know, reached a point where if the United States really perceives a lower priority on a region, then retrenchment has to be on the table and part of the mix, whether it's just retrenchment to hand things off to U.S. allies and partners, or whether part of that retrenchment will be used to make a diplomatic agreement with U.S. adversaries that might improve the regional architecture.
Ukrainian President Zelensky recently proposed a peace formula, which calls for a kind of a truce, a full Russian withdrawal from Ukraine, including Crimea, Russian reparations, prosecution of war crimes. Moscow has indicated it's a non-starter. I wonder if you have anything to say about how Biden should understand the prospects of a negotiated settlement. What kind of compromises do you think make sense here?
Well, two things are true at once. The Biden White House has said from the beginning of the full-scale invasion of Ukraine that it expects the war to end through diplomatic means. At the same time, it has built up a kind of expectation that Ukraine will achieve victory, and it has declined to identify the terms on which a peace that's acceptable to the United States could be reached. It said it's not going to pressure Ukraine to adopt war aims different from what it has, or peace aims different from what it has. So in practice, the administration has deferred to the government of Ukraine on both of these important questions. It's pretty hard to say, you know, what the eventual terms of peace will be. What I think is sort of clearer is that it's very unlikely that either Ukraine or Russia will achieve the maximal objectives that they're both, claiming that they're fighting for. And Zelensky's formula is a formula for Ukrainian victory. I'm not exactly sure why at that point you need to have negotiations if Ukraine has been so successful to be able to impose the terms, which sound, you know, totally just to me. It sounds great. It's just not going to happen. And so in practice, that's not a peace proposal. That's a proposal for victory. A lot will depend, I think, on where the line of contact between Ukrainian and Russian forces stands when a negotiation takes place. I don't expect that Russia will make all that many compromises with territory that it has come to occupy and that it has claimed to have annexed into the Russian Federation. I could be wrong about that, but, you know, I hear a lot of people in Washington talk about how, well, Russia's not interested in peace because it hasn't moved its forces out of occupied Ukrainian territory, or it hasn't said that it would be willing to give up portions of Ukraine that it occupies. Unfortunately, I think it's wishful thinking to take those as those steps as signs of seriousness about negotiating. So we're pretty long ways away from having a realistic policy conversation, I'm afraid, about where things can end up. What I am hoping is that what I take to be the right lessons are drawn from the problems that President Biden has had in getting Ukraine aid renewed in the U.S. Congress. I think that there's an opportunity here that tragically much of the White House is missing, and members of Congress are also missing, which is to make U.S. strategy less capacious with respect to Ukraine, rule out certain things that the United States wouldn't do, like support Ukraine if it were to try to retake Crimea, which would pose real escalation risks that the United States would take very seriously. Start a dialogue with a view towards finding out what Russia's real terms might be. I think it's going to be a long process. It's not going to happen quickly. But, that process needs to happen. So I think if there were, more emphasis from the United States on the desirability of the war ending sooner rather than later, some limits, some declared limits on what the United States is supporting the Ukrainians to achieve, perhaps an expression of, relative agnosticism about where exactly the borders end up in the future. And these are issues that can change well into the future. These things would, I think, show that the United States is more interested in ending the war than it has been to date. And I think that could also put the Ukraine aid on a more a sustainable basis in the U.S. Congress, because these fights are not going to end. Even the $60 billion request, that was supposed to cover a year. So if Biden is reelected, we're going to be back at this question again with the next Congress. If Biden is not reelected, then the president will be Trump, and I wouldn't expect Ukraine aid to flow as readily in that scenario.
You write that instead of retrenching, the Biden administration is seeking to build connective tissue between U.S. allies in Europe and Asia. Can you explain this idea? What's the logic here?
So shortly after Russia invaded Ukraine, the administration started to develop this new argument about stitching U.S. allies and security partners together across regions, especially across Europe and Asia. And I think the sort of proximate spur for this argument was getting some U.S. allies and partners in Asia to provide military equipment to Ukraine. But I think this has become a kind of rhetorical exercise or theory for the administration to try to hold on to its initial desire to limit the costs and risks of U.S. foreign policy and security policy to the United States and deliver a foreign policy for the middle class. So they've linked this concept of having connective tissue between U.S. allies and partners across regions to the claim that National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan has recently made, that we're seeing the most burden sharing in some period of time. What I take this theory to signal is that in lieu of the United States retrenching either from Europe or Asia or the Middle East for that matter, the idea is to limit U.S. burdens by getting the allies to do more, not just in their own regions, but across regions. So I have not seen any clear metrics coming out of the administration for, you know, how to, if this is their strategy and they're serious about limiting U.S. burdens or even reducing U.S. burdens by having allies and partners assist each other, I have not seen them articulate, you know, what their metrics are for success over the, you know, 1 year, 2 years, 4 years, etc. And my sense is that a lot of this is rhetoric. And it's also, you know, it sounds commonsensical. Of course, you know, if allies are willing to make a contribution to the defense of one another, why wouldn't we support that? And I don't disagree with that. But my fear is that this theory is being used to sort of deflect away from the fact that the costs and risks the United States is bearing are going up, and they're not going to be offset by U.S. Allies and partners making what are almost inevitably going to be pretty token contributions to other theaters. It would make much more sense to have Europeans focused on defending Europe, which they have an actual interest in doing, a greater interest than the United States does, than to have them send a frigate over to patrol the South China Sea in a symbolic show of support. I think that's kind of the what the idea in practice amounts to, right? So I'd like to see the administration either give us some real metrics so we can understand that its proposal is serious, or more preferably promote a division of a clear division of labor between the United States and its allies and partners that would, in particular, have Europeans focused on the territorial defense of Europe and Asian allies and partners focused on their regions as well.
You, speaking of rhetoric, you wrote another piece in The Atlantic on President Biden's primary rhetorical approach to foreign policy, which has been to frame America's global purpose on normative grounds as the kind of guardian and bestower of democracy and the vigilant enemy of autocracies. And you argue that this democracy-first framing is divisive and may be making overseas conflict worse. How so?
So in both of these pieces, I was trying to reflect on what to make of the Biden administration after almost its first term. And I was trying to think about what's been distinctive about Joe Biden. So one of the things that I realized was that Biden has taken a kind of remarkably one-sided view on foreign policy flashpoints, namely Ukraine, Israel, Gaza, and Taiwan. Now, all three of the countries involved, Ukraine, Israel, Taiwan, not a country, but a entity, these are all longstanding U.S. security partners. So it's not particularly surprising that Biden has stood by them. But he stood by them to such a degree that I think, you know, Barack Obama wouldn't have. I think Donald Trump wouldn't have. And part of the reason for that may be the president's attachment to framing foreign policy issues around the battle between democracy versus autocracy, something that he's done from the outset of his administration. So if you take the case of Taiwan, the president has first of all framed U.S.-China relations around this battle between democracy and autocracy. He's also made a number of statements on Taiwan that contradict U.S. foreign policy, even the policy that his administration claims it continues to follow, and that he inherited from his predecessors. He's twice remarked, for example, that the issue of independence for Taiwan, well, that's up to Taiwanese, to the people of Taiwan, to decide. Well, U.S. policy is, in fact, that we're trying to deter Taiwan from making unilateral moves toward independence, which we understand would be destabilizing and be received as provocative to Beijing. So the policy line that Biden's predecessors have used is we do not support Taiwan independence. And the White House, to their credit, you know, continues to use that line. Senior U.S. officials use that line, but it's still damaging when the president slips into some other mode of reasoning, which I think has a lot to do with, you know, the idea that the legitimacy of Taiwan stems from its democracy. That's what we care about. Therefore, you know, does it make sense for me to say that Taiwan shouldn't be independent or that I don't support Taiwan's independence? No, instead, you know, the issue should be up to the voters, the people. That's a democratic principle, to be sure, but it's not one that makes for good U.S. policy or cross-strait stability. So I think that's, you know, that's an illustration of how I think using this frame of democracy versus autocracy can deepen division and prove to be destabilizing. I think on, you know, the war in Ukraine, where he's used this framing the most, it's really been counterproductive. Much of the world, which has declined to join in the sanctions on Russia, does not want to sign up for a struggle between democracy and autocracy. They, first of all, some of them aren't democracies. So that principle inherently excludes them and is contrary to their interests. The struggle between democracy and autocracy is also one that doesn't seem likely to end. Many of them would like to see the war come to an end sooner rather than later. But I think it also gets wrong what's actually at stake in Ukraine. Russia's invasion of Ukraine would be illegal, regardless of whether, you know, Vladimir Putin was a dictator or a popularly elected president in a strong multi-party democracy. And Ukraine's status as a democracy is questionable. I call it a fledgling democracy in the piece. Its Freedom House ranking is quite low. It's very well known that it has had huge problems with corruption throughout the post-Cold War period and down to the present day. It's not necessary to make the case for supporting Ukraine on the grounds that Ukraine is a democracy and that Russia is an autocracy. And I think it's indeed counterproductive. Nor do I think it plays well domestically. And this is something where I think Joe Biden is not in sync with where the country is today. This is in part because, who's supporting democracy and who's a threat to democracy has become sadly a political football here. So when Biden frames the Ukraine issue in terms of democracy versus autocracy, these are kind of the same things he's saying about Donald Trump, the leader of the Republican Party. That is not actually a unifying message that is conducive to getting Republican votes for his policy. So I think he thinks democracy should be a unifying message. It has perhaps served to be a unifying message in domestic politics in the past. But today, I think a much more unifying message would be one that focused on U.S. interests, focused on the principle of sovereignty for Ukraine, and left out some of the more ideologically charged rationales that play pretty well in allied capitals in Europe and not very well in the United States and around the world besides Europe.
You touch upon the prospects for any of this retrenchment actually happening, and you argue that, you know, it won't happen unless a candidate, you know, campaigns on it, firmly believes in its wisdom, and actively staffs their administration with like-minded retrenchers, you know, to enable the bureaucracy to actually effectuate such a change. In other words, it takes quite a bit of commitment to turn the ship of state on this kind of grand strategy type of thing. And as we look down the dark double barrel of a Trump-Biden rematch, it would seem these kind of genuine, realist, restraint-oriented changes to U.S. foreign policy are probably off the table for the next 4 years, huh?
It looks like it. But, a couple buts. So let's take the prospect of a Biden re-election. So, not many signs that Joe Biden is interested in retrenchment at this point. He seems that only in his first year was such an idea on the table, and it was on the table really only with respect to the Middle East. Having said that, the Ukraine issue is dynamic. I think there's a middle ground to be found in American politics that would involve the United States continuing to aid Ukraine, albeit for more specific strategic reasons and with greater emphasis on seeking an end to the conflict, but also on promoting burden sharing or even burden shifting to European allies as we go forward. And I don't know that Joe Biden, you know, that it's beyond him to see that Ukraine aid is not on a sustainable footing right now, and to ask, how can I make a deal with members of Congress to put it in a better place? Are we far along that process of Biden realizing this, and or even Republican critics of Ukraine aid proposing such a thing? We are not far at all. But in a second term, you know, it is something to think about. Not predicting, not putting any money down, but something that is perhaps not out of the realm of possibility. Also, it's pretty important for those who want the United States to practice retrenchment that the Biden administration hold firm and not take meaningful steps to bring Ukraine into NATO, and that the Biden administration think again or fail in an effort to make a U.S. security guarantee to Saudi Arabia. And again, those issues are very much in play. Now, what about a Trump victory? There's a lot of talk about Trump being someone who is an isolationist or wants to pull the United States back from the world stage. He's not really talking about that very much. He's talking about ending the war in Ukraine through a magical round of diplomacy. He's talking about how it wouldn't have happened if he were president. That's actually not a mentality that suggests a president who would practice retrenchment, because Trump is putting forward a version of the mainstream establishment theory of peace through strength, that if the United States does enough primacy and strengthens its position, then all other actors will be persuaded to not challenge the United States, and thus there will be a basic kind of peace and stability. I mean, that's pretty much the Biden administration's theory, or de facto theory, given its desire to prioritize security in Asia over Europe and the Middle East, but its unwillingness to disentangle the United States from Europe and the Middle East. Trump has his own twist on that, which is to personalize the theory of peace through strength. The strength is not just about American military strength, but also about Donald Trump's personal toughness and perceived toughness. But, you know, it's the same theory, just a variation. So, and if you look at, you know, Trump has been president. We have 4 years of evidence. And as you've written, John, you know, U.S. alliances expanded on his watch. None of them contracted. The United States did not get out of any wars. Okay, none. the United States upped its military spending, a trajectory that continues. Not a whole lot of restraint in Trump's foreign policy. His big claim that he ran on was that he didn't start any new wars. That's how low the bar is. And I guess he arguably cleared it. Arguably. That said, look, I mean, a second Trump term could be different from the first. Trump is not a realist and restrainer, but he's also not a committed primacist. I would say mostly he doesn't really have a strategic view. He clearly doesn't get the mainstream theory of why the United States does primacy, why it leads a so-called world order, why it scatters its troops in so many places. So he asks lots of questions about why are we doing this. In the main, though, his move has been to, you know, threaten to withdraw from alliances in an effort to shake down U.S. allies to get them to pay more and to get better terms for Trump. And I think you can read his latest comments about NATO in that light as well. He's going to scare people and then try to get them to do more and then claim it's been a big success. So it's possible that he'll hire different kinds of people who will nurture some of his instincts in a more retrenchment-oriented direction. And if there are enough people in the bureaucracy who are committed to this course of action, and if Trump, and if it's proposed to Trump and Trump is actually favorable toward it and willing to incur some political costs, then, you know, it's not out of the question. But I wouldn't, again, with even odds, not putting money on it. Let's see it when it happens. But looking beyond that, you know, we're stuck, it appears, with Trump and Biden right now. Two really old guys who have also run before. So the feeling of getting stuck is something that I'm certainly feeling. But in the future, neither Joe Biden nor probably Donald Trump is going to be running for president. And we're going to see younger generations come into power that are post-Cold War generations or war on terror generations. You know, the Democratic Party is, I think, stirring again on foreign policy as a result of Biden's staunch support for Israel's military operations in Gaza. So, you know, if I look out 10 years or 20 years, will the United States practice retrenchment? I can't tell you who will do it, and I can't tell you exactly how, but I think the odds get considerably higher.
Here's to the future. Stephen Wertheim, thanks for coming back on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you.